The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Abandonment is a fear that we will be left alone forever with no one to protect us. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, shit show is a term of endearment around here. It is of the highest honor. You know, I used to say former shit show, but recovering shit show is more appropriate. You know, I don't ever want to not have that shit show card available to me. Like, the times that I've grown the most have been from the shit shows, right? The shit shows have been the catalyst to, the growth and healing in my life. So I'm open to some more shit shows because I still want to grow, but can we please just not have them be as excruciatingly painful as the shit shows I have endured in the past? So today, we're diving deep with abandonment trauma guru Susan Anderson. This is her third time on the pod. Go listen to her first two episodes. I'll put them in the show notes. And I was thinking about our first interview together. I was on the floor in my closet next to my cat's litter box. And I knew that I knew within moments of her hopping on Zoom that we were going to get on well, because I made some sort of comment about how it looked like she was sitting on a toilet seat. Like, it looked like she was sitting on the toilet. And she laughed at that. And so I said, okay, this is my gal. We're going to get along just fine. So Susan was the pioneer for abandonment trauma, which is one of the questions that I got to ask her in this interview was, you know, what was her process, her research of, you know, as it relates to abandonment trauma? Because when she started to look into this, there really wasn't much out there. And you'll hear her share how, you know, she was looking at a lot of research and studies that were with baboons and attachment theory. So it's quite profound. And thank God for people like her who have, you know, spearheaded the education, the research, the ways in which we can heal so that we now, you know, have an opportunity to not be a prisoner to our childhood trauma and actually be able to work through some of this stuff. So we're talking about the impact of being rejected by your peers. What else are we talking into about talking into? What else are we talking into, folks? Oh, and the other thing we talked about was learning to equate love with insecurity as kids. Like, how does that happen? So let's just moving on, folks. But first, you need to damn the join shit show. This is my online community. I want to share with you a story from today. So at the very end of group today, I just started like hysterically crying tears of joy. So Sandra, one of our most treasured members of this community, hopefully y'all have listened to her shit show Saturday. Actually, I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well, because I actually have the interview on YouTube, not just the audio. So Sandra is, you know, a 75-year-old Black woman who just celebrated 5 years of sobriety and just began her adult child recovery journey in the past few years. And Sandra had one of the most horrendous childhoods ever. She was married to a malignant narcissist for over 20 years. She's battled with alcoholism on and off her entire life. But I mean, on top of that though, like, she was the first person in her family to go to college. And then she was a literature professor for decades at a university in California. But Sandra, her entire life, because of her experiences, you know, she's hated men. And it has been through another member of our community, Andrew, who is a white dude from Kentucky with a Southern drawl. And it has been Andrew that has shown Sandra that there are good men out there. And it's just like in today's world where people are so fucking pitted against each other, right? It's so beautiful to have this space where we're just all connecting on this shared experience of growing up in a dysfunctional family and wanting to do something about it. And God, it just hit me. Just how profound this community is. I don't take enough time, I think, to really acknowledge and kind of just like sit in the gratitude and the being proud of myself for what I've created. It definitely was divinely inspired. I don't know if anyone who's new, like, I think it was between Brian number one and Brian number two, I literally had a life chart reading. She said to me, I see you running your own recovery meetings in the future. And at that point in time, I really didn't even know that I was an adult child, I don't think. And I just remember her saying that and being like, boring. Like, she said, my purpose in this life was spiritual. And she talked about like recovery groups. I'm like, this fucking sounds lame as shit. It's crazy. She was just talking about how my gift is that I have ability to, you know, communicate things to other people in a way in which people can, you know, receive it versus if somebody else said it. So damn the Join shit show. Come on, you folks. And so I want to give a shout out to the newest members of the shit show community. So thank you, thank you, thank you to Mitchell, Nick, Chapman, Kathy, Adam, Deborah, Jennifer, Joanna, Georgina, Sarah, Louisa, Susan, Rose, Paige, Elizabeth, Amity, Shri, Rebecca, Sarah, Alex, Sarah, another Sarah, Christy, Susan, Erica, and Mark. Thank you, you fine ass shit shows. The rest of y'all, follow suit. See the damn link in the bio next. Go subscribe to my newsletter. So I sent out a newsletter on Monday, and what it is a meditation. It is a inner family member takeover practice and reparenting exercise. So this is something that you can use when you get triggered to help you figure out what, you know, what part of you needs your intention and reparenting them. It's super simple and easy. So see the link in the bio to for that. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. I know that there's people listening right now that have been listening for years and have not done that. And you're probably like, oh, I'm just, you know, one person. Like, what does it matter? It does. So if you, you know, if you don't know how to do it too, hit me up. I'll tell you how to do it. Thank you. Love you all.
Let's just rock and roll. I got a bunch of stuff that I thought we could talk about. So there's no end to all the things that we can talk. Is there anything that you're excited about or that you want to talk about?
This is probably not relevant to what you're doing today, but I noticed on Instagram, which I don't even do Instagram, but when I look to see my own stuff on Instagram, mm-hmm. I notice everybody's whining and complaining about narcissists.
No shit, I know.
So, you know, it's all abandonment, but it's defensive abandonment. It's, you're a narcissist, not I've been abandoned. You're a narcissist, not I feel rejected and it wasn't mutual and I loved you more than you loved me and the relationship didn't work and I'm a fuck up and I can't make it work and it keeps happening and nobody ever loves me the way I love them. And, you know, no, you're a narcissist. It's like it's defensive abandonment. And it's amazing to see because I guess, you know, it's not the worst thing I've ever seen, but it is It's just that it's bullshit.
Yeah, no, we've talked about this a lot. So I'd love to get your perspective on it from an abandonment side. Because, yeah, I mean, it is. Everybody's a narcissist. People are projecting, you know, incorrect information about what a narcissist is. I mean, it's just all of, I was just, the girl that I had for my interview yesterday, we were talking about this, about just like the victimhood that is spread through social media, right?
Yes.
She is, we're just like mid-size. I don't want to have to, everybody, Susan Anderson, she's back. You don't even need a damn introduction. I'll give it to you more in the beginning. Third time, welcome back. We're mid-sentence. I didn't want to cut this off and go into it. We're talking about victimhood on social media. So this girl is, she focuses on people-pleasing. And I was like, do you believe that there are certain misconceptions being put out there about people-pleasing? And she goes, the thing that bothers me the most is that people are like, you know, this is a trauma response. This is a, like, you know, just kind of like the, well, this is the way I am, which is true. But also you need to recognize that like your actions and behaviors can be harmful to other people. And you also are responsible for your own healing. And she was saying that it's so clear, like when she posts something that is about like taking personal accountability versus another post that is like more like, you know, kind of like not poor me, but you know what I mean? That like it's night and day, like how the more victim-y posts do so much better than ones that are about us taking personal accountability.
Well, the victim-y position that all of us take in many, many situations is easier. It's the inner child feeling, oh, poor me. Somebody hurt my feelings. I'm helpless and powerless. And I'm just, you know, I'm a helpless little person and I can't stand up for myself.
She means a small person, folks, not a midget.
But the higher person, the one with the cerebral cortex part of us, then gets on top of that if we have a good, you know, adult self. And we say, wait a minute, let me take responsibility. Let me not fall into this. It feels good to feel like a victim and other people identify with me, but let me use this as a growth opportunity. Let me see what part I played, et cetera. So it's natural to feel like a victim, especially with abandonment. When you feel that you have been cut off from some supply that somebody was giving you, love, friendship, whatever it was, employment. I mean, there are so many scenarios where you can feel slighted by a source that's important to you, by something that's giving you a sense of security. And when that is pulled away, it is only natural for the first reaction to be, I'm a victim. You had no right to do that. I'm a victim. The second reaction is, I'm inadequate. Look, I'm not worth keeping. Mm-hmm. I'm worthless. Mm-hmm. I'm not enough. And all the shame comes out. Then third comes through with, I hate feeling all the shame. I have to be the adult, take responsibility and learn from this and get on my own 2 feet and not be so dependent on another person or a job to give me everything. I have to give it to myself. It's a tremendously, I make it sound like, oh, one, two, three.
One, two,
no.
Yeah, just easiest careers.
Yes, it's such an arduous process. But the victim part is the most natural feeling. And it also protects the ego. If you and I have an interaction and I leave the interaction feeling slighted and disrespected, and if I feel that you did this to me, I'm protecting my ego from feeling that I'm an idiot and it was my fault. Mm-hmm. So it's perfectly healthy to have a victim-y initial response to something. But, you know, because we're protecting ourselves from feeling inadequate, which we all feel inside. And eventually we will feel that way, even if it's not fair and valid. We'll say, oh, it's my fault. I didn't present myself well enough. I didn't know how to command the other person or hold my power or whatever. You could, you know, then there's the taking responsibility part. But this is a process that has to do with just being a human being, mm-hmm. and being vulnerable and living on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so she brought this up because she brought it up in respect to seeing a lot of posts on social media about narcissism. And I love that you called it what? Defensive abandonment. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because all right, so you and I, let's say, have an interaction and you pull away. And the first thing I do is I say, I'm hurt. I feel like a victim. Look, you're mean. My first reaction is you did this to me. You're to blame. Your character's bad. You treated me unfairly. And then if I can gather enough, you know, evidence, you're a narcissist. Mm-hmm. That you and I entered into a conversation and you cut me off and I'm left feeling bad, mm-hmm. because you're a narcissist and you didn't consider my feelings and it's all about you and you were just using me as a supply to make you feel better. And so then that's why I say it's defensive for abandonment, because it allows the abandonment victim-y horrible feeling. Self-pity is the worst. It feels horrible. It protects the ego, but it's so painful. It allows some anger to say, no, you. And so there is the taking the abandonment feelings and putting it on the other person. And the irony is that there is a lot of stuff out there happening, because there are a lot of people who are narcissistic in the sense that they don't have the capacity to be a we. They stay an I, and everything, all of their decisions and their behaviors are based on self-interest, and they haven't really taken in the other person and, you know, made a commitment to doing what they can to be sensitive and kind to the other person. You know, so there really are people out there who look very attractive and know all the right things to say, but who don't have that emotional capacity. They don't have that ability to share. Mm-hmm. And they stay very self-involved, and it's always their own self-interest. They're always on top dog, you know. And so there are a lot of genuine narcissists out there. And for all of those relationships that the narcissists are having, there are people feeling hurt and rejected and abandoned and dismissed and treated unfairly. So there's a lot of legitimate.
Yeah, but isn't it almost narcissistic in a way for the person that's saying that, because they're refusing to take a look at themselves?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
like the person saying that the other one is narcissistic.
Yes.
Like in a way that is narcissistic.
There's a lot of it is projection. I mean, it is true that we can get into a relationship with another person who's attractive because their narcissism is so attractive, mm-hmm. and sexy. Mm-hmm. You know, they think who the hell they are. They carry themselves a certain way. They have everything together because they're putting themselves first all the time. So naturally they have, their car is perfect and neat and freshly clean. You know, naturally, you know, their life is going a certain way because they are narcissistic. But there's a lot of projection because the other person also has some, you know, I call it positive narcissism.
But
has a feeling of, you know, I'm a good person. I do care about other people. I wouldn't have done that to him or her. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have done that. What they did to me hurt me. I wouldn't have done that, which mm-hmm. may be untrue. The victim-y person may be projecting and may well be a potential abandoner of someone else in a very, you know, uncaring way. But anyway, I'm a good person and I have value. And so that's the positive narcissism, looking at the self and looking to make sure that you have attributes that make you worthwhile and valuable to another person. Because underneath that, we feel not enough, inadequate, not, you know, we don't have, you know, holding capacity. That there's a fear. Even if we don't feel it, we fear that that might be happening. And it's very unconscious. But then to defend against that, we have, no, I have very good attributes. I'm very proud of myself. I'm a good person. I'm fair to people. I'm kind. I have friends who can validate that. I take care of myself. You know, all the positive things that we say. So the positive narcissism can make the person blame the other person, because I'm a good person and they didn't treat me well and I didn't deserve that. I mean, it just gets so much projection going on, and a lot of it hides the you know, the raw emotions.
The shame.
It hides. Yeah, yeah, it hides all of that. It hides what you're really feeling. So some of it is, it's very understandable that people, you know, accuse each other of being a narcissist and all of that. That's very understandable, but it's also unfortunate that a lot of energy gets wasted when what needs to happen is for this to be an opportunity to strengthen the sense of self and develop a better relationship with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this brings up something that I wanted to discuss with you as far as the internalizing phase stage of your abandonment process, recovery process. Let me pull this up. You have this, I never noticed it before, but it is the, what is it? Like, there's like kind of like the five different phases of it. Let me pull it up.
It was like it's bell swirl, it's shattering.
De-idolizing and then the rage and the, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, internalizing.
Yeah, yeah.
The middle stage is internalizing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but like within that, there was like a bunch of stages within there. You had like a chart, you know?
Yes, and it all starts with an I. You take the other person, they go on a pedestal because they were superior to you in that they managed to abandon you. So, you know, that makes them automatically up on a pedestal, and that makes you want to put them, to knock them off their pedestal by saying, you're bad, you are a narcissist, but the internalizing is, oh, look, I can't hold on to somebody. I'm not special enough. I'm not successful enough, or I'm not beautiful enough, or, you know, all the things that men or women say, you know, from the Barbie movie, you know, man, I'm just Ken. I didn't have enough to offer. I just do beach. You know, I'm not enough of a big shot. And that's the male stereotype for what makes many people feel so worthless. And for women, I'm not beautiful enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm, you know, all the stereotypic things. But that those are the feelings that are going on in internalizing, blaming yourself, beating yourself up for being too needy, not independent enough, you know, not having a strong enough sense of self to be impressive, not having enough moxie to hold the other person's interest, and all of those things, these terrible, demoralizing self-immolation.
I'm trying to find this damn, there's like a, yeah, it's like five different things that you have listed in boxes. I can't fucking find it.
It's not just swirl and jet.
No, you have these different stages within the
within internalizing.
Yeah, and there's like the something rage. There's like a form of rage. There's a
impotent rage.
Wait, say it again.
The impotent rage.
Yeah.
Because when you're internalizing, your rage is so, it's not phallic rage where you're standing up and you're saying, I refuse to beat myself up any longer. It's not that rage that you finally get to in the next stage called rage. Impotent rage. It's I'm so mad at you. You know, it's a weak kind of a whining kind of a feeling of just feeling overpowered by the other person. And the rage is just mostly it's rage toward the self. But the little bit of flailing, beating up your pillow, you know, and pretending it's the other person, it's so ineffective. Who does it affect? Can I tell you what I did during internalizing when I was going through it in my abandonment?
I would love to
hear. I had a braid almost all the way down to the floor. I cut it off.
Wow.
That'll get them.
For sure. How'd that work out for you?
Yeah.
And then like, I was going to get back together, but then I saw you cut your damn braid off. It's no, thank you.
No, then I went into hair hell because now I had hair mm-hmm. and I had been in a braid for like 20 years. And now I had hair
mm-hmm.
that had to be like, fixed. I don't know.
That's so good.
Well, that got him. That really got him.
You sure got him there.
Yeah.
I can't find this damn thing. I did just want to, before we get into all of this, I did kind of want to start. So just really quickly, since it's been a couple years since you were initially on, like your adult abandonment story is you were in a marriage for a long time. And then your husband ended up wanting to separate, and that was unexpected to you, correct?
Yeah, shock at a total shock.
Yeah. And then you had another relationship that was healthy and happy. And then did he pass away or did you guys separate?
He died.
Okay.
He died.
Uh-huh. So this is what I wanted to ask you. We haven't like, and just with talking with Peter, I wanted to learn more about this because I'm very curious. Like, talk about your process of like really starting to research this abandonment trauma and like, what did it look like in those early days? Like how did you develop all of these theories? Like, what did that process like look like for you? And like, where did you start? And what were some really key moments that really helped you to develop your view on all of this?
Well, I was already a therapist. Mm-hmm. I had, you know, I worked in a school.
Yeah, where Peter
school,
was.
Yes, mm-hmm. I was working on like an anti-abandonment program. Although at the time, before my own abandonment, I thought of it as separation anxiety. That kids had disconnected. There was a lot of disconnection in the parent-child relationship. And I had programs to strengthen it and to strengthen
the bond.
What
brought that up for you? Like, why did that become your thing?
It was always my interest based on my childhood history.
Okay.
Probably. Okay. But it was an area that of sensitivity that I saw that the bottom line of having emotional problems and psychiatric problems was separation anxiety, and that some psychiatric problems were caused, you know, by other things, genetics or whatever. But the separation anxiety that it caused, having the genetics that caused the breakdown, that people really needed connection. So I was, that's what I specialized in. So then my own beloved, love of my life, hot partner left me after 18 years for another woman. It suddenly, boom, out the door. And I was so devastated. And at the time, I was at the top of my game. I was very successful, confident, competent, you know, a relatively accomplished, don't picture world famous or anything like this, but I was at the top of my game. I was a very seasoned therapist with a full private practice and a full-time job in a school system. And I ran parenting education for several districts. And I was really, really soaring as a person who functioned in a very independent way. When he left me, my knees collapsed. I could hardly stand up. I could hardly get through an hour at work without sobbing. Even at a meeting in front of other people, I would be sitting there with the need to run out the door and burst out crying. I was devastated and ripped to the guts. Now,
do you remember when he told you, like, do you remember the conversation when he told you that he wanted to get separated?
Well, he said, I don't love you anymore. I want to leave.
And it was just like a regular old day?
It was at night and it was 10:30 and he had suddenly not come home, which I thought was highly scary because it would mean that he had an accident or something. And then he walked in the door and I was relieved that he was alive And then he looked at me and said, I don't love you anymore. I want to leave. And
that did was... you have any suspicion up until that point?
No, we were planning a trip together and no suspicion.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay.
Sorry. No, there hadn't been a change. The change is that a flirtation that he was having was consummated that day.
Got it.
Yeah. And then it made him feel that he had fallen in love with someone else, that had been an attraction going on for, mm-hmm. you know, a while. Nothing that interfered with our relationship, but it was a side attraction. Mm-hmm. And he then thought he had fallen in love with a person, but she never left her husband. So mm-hmm. he left his family, mm-hmm. me and my two daughter, children. Yeah. Yes. And son. Mm-hmm. He left us and went off to be with her, and she never left her husband. So eventually their relationship ran out. But in the meantime, I was so devastated. And when he was gone for those first 2 years, my self-esteem suffered. Like if I caught a reflection of myself walking, you know, past a store or something, and I would think, that's the hideous person. That was me. I never had that before. I would catch my reflection and say, oh, hi, you know. But I could tell that my self-esteem had been really hurt. My sense of confidence. And of course, my friends who saw me always on top of the world, and he was madly in love with me, and we were this wonderful couple. And now they saw that I was discarded, thrown away by him. So they looked at me wondering, I wonder if there's more there's more than meets the eye. There must be mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. wrong with her. So I lost esteem in my own eyes and in the eyes of, you know, my friend, a lot of my friends.
Do you really think that's true? Or do you think that that's what your head was telling you regarding your friends?
I didn't think it at the time. It was afterwards in having very frank, honest exchanges with people and writing the book.
Okay.
It's human nature. Okay. You know, yeah. Why did, I was all such a name. Why did Jennifer Aniston lose what's his name?
Brad Pitt?
Maybe. Yeah, him. Maybe he wasn't quite, maybe she wasn't quite up to par. You know, it's a reflection on the person who's left. Yeah. They're the ones who were thrown away.
Especially at that. Yeah. Especially back then too, even more so.
Yeah. So anyway, so then that made me wonder, how could you take a person who, how could I lose self-esteem? I was at the top of my career. How could that happen? And the answer was, because when baboons in the Serengeti, it was found that when they went through grief, the alpha baboon, they would sneak in, scientists, researchers, and take blood samples of baboons while they were sleeping and determine that their corticosteroids were elevated when there was a death in the troop. And the alpha baboon would no longer be so alpha. So he would stop dominating the troop. If he was the one experiencing a major loss in one of his strong attachments, especially to a female baboon. And that during the time that he was acting wimpy, all the other baboons would jockey for new positions because now the alpha baboon wasn't around. So the losing someone has such an impact on the baboon's, you know, endocrinological, you know, stress hormones and all of that, and brain and body had such an impact that it actually changed behavior and turned an alpha into a wimpy baboon. That's what had happened to me. So I had to go on a research mission and find out more. And that's what started it. Reading about the baboons, which came out of some remote paper, Robert Sapolsky. It wasn't out of a book. It was some paper that was some remote title. I had a research mentor who found it for me. And that's what got me started. So I started doing research and research and research for 3 years. I did nothing but study what happens physiologically when you've had a trauma and when the trauma is rejection and loss.
And how are you doing that? Like reading things, or you were talking to
people?
Well,
there was nobody studied it in humans. It had never been studied. They knew a little bit here, you know, Bowlby and different people.
When is this? The '80s? The '90s?
This was in the mid '90s.
Okay.
But I studied animal psychology, and, you know, like the baboon study wasn't for humans to understand their own behavior. It was to study stress hormones.
Mm.
So there were all these researchers who were studying other things. But if you read their reports, you'd think, hey, wait a minute, that relates to this.
Mm.
So I just studied and studied and studied, and I had a research mentor because many of the studies had to be explained to me,
mm-hmm.
and also had to be obtained from various, you know, universities. This was before you could look it up on your phone. And it became my mission to try and understand, how could you take a person who was, you know, so feeling so great and make me so low self-esteem that I could hardly walk. I found myself to be hideous and, you know, really low self-esteem. It just, I crashed. And of course, then there's the whole psychological component, the post-traumatic grief and having it trigger old emotions from childhood, et cetera, et cetera.
So, okay. You've talked about your childhood some, and I know you struggled with your weight, and there's definitely some neglect, but like, were you just like a normie? Like, was complex trauma not showing up in your adult life until this happened? Did you have a pattern of like unhealthy relationships? Like, were you just getting off? Oh, lucky you. Lucky you, I did. Susan.
I did. I had the childhood thing was that I was severely obese and the only obese child in my school and person in the town. It just turned out that way. And then I lost weight. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then I became popular and normal. Then I had unhealthy relationships where I was at the victim end. And then I met my partner, mm-hmm. the one who wound up abandoning me. But we had 18 years of bliss. And it was amazing that all of the abuse from my earlier relationships didn't prevent me from really having a full,
not
all
fair.
Four burners going. But also, I discovered a diet back in 1968. It was called Stillman. It's old, but no carbs. It was a no carb. It was a precursor to Atkins.
Sounds horrible.
And I went from constantly struggling with my weight, because, you know, I have metabolic disorder. My body wants to be fat. And I found a way to stay thin.
Mm-hmm.
And I look good thin. I don't look so good when I'm packing like an extra 40 or 50 pounds. So my self-esteem was so dependent on how thin I was. It's a whole commentary. That itself is the book. How could the horrors that I went through as a kid be solved? Because I lost weight at the end of the fifth grade, and now I had a million friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I always knew that it wasn't me that they liked. It was the fact that I looked okay now.
Mm-hmm.
It was dependent. It wasn't unconditional. It was conditional. So I went all through the rest of my life knowing that acceptance was conditional.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm. What do you know about your parents' upbringings? I don't think I've ever asked you that. The truth of the matter, my dear shit shows, is that there is a huge overlap in those of us who grew up in a dysfunctional family and those of us who are suffering from ADHD. I myself got diagnosed with ADHD about a year ago, and getting this diagnosis and treating this diagnosis has made such a difference in my productivity and getting shit done. Now, let me tell you about Done. Done is an online ADHD care platform where you can get all the resources you need to help manage your ADHD.
Take a free 1-minute assessment and book an appointment with a licensed ADHD clinician as soon as the next day. Get continuous care, one-click refills, insurance coverage, and 24/7 care team support with Done for just $79 a month and pharmacy copays as low as $0. Visit get.donefirst.com/podcast to learn more. Again, that is get.donefirst.com/podcast. Done. Turn ADHD into your strength.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Well, my parents were, you know, complicated people. They weren't perfect, but they were together and they tried to, I could, you know, tell you many stories where things didn't work out so well for me. But if you look at the whole thing, I had a relatively normal childhood. Mm-hmm. And my parents were okay. They were post World War II. My father had been in World War II, and then came home from the war and had
was
me.
Was he in
right
combat?
But he was a flight instructor.
So was my grandfather.
Really?
Mm-hmm. He taught aerobatics.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a conversation for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the whole thing about, you know, passing the dysfunctional family along, I don't think my family, going back a number of generations, had like an undue amount of trauma. They had some, and you can trace all my stuff back to it. But in these years, I have worked with so many people, probably up till the thousands at this point, who came from families with such traumas going on.
Yeah.
Like transgenerational, like Peter. Yes.
Mm. So what was, you're going through this research, like, were there any really pivotal moments, like, where you were like, oh, fuck, that's it? Like, what were some highlights? Like, what are some of your proudest moments in kind of developing your theories around abandonment trauma? Like, do you remember when Peter came up with that? I asked him that question. I was like, do you remember when you said the drain, the siphon off the
invisible
self-esteem?
Drain of self-esteem.
Yeah. He said you guys were at lunch, but like moments like that, or like, was there ever a time like, oh shit, I never thought about it that way. Or you've done so much. So, but I'm just curious.
Well, I think probably the most profound moment was, and this guided the shape of the abandonment recovery mm-hmm. program, was when I discovered that, you know, we all have all of this thwarted attachment energy. The idea that mammals are attachment creatures, they attach in order to survive. And humans are very much in that of that ilk. They attach. Infants can't survive on their own. We have a drive to attachment. Mm-hmm. And in order to procreate, we have to attach mm-hmm. for the children, for the babies to survive and so forth. So we have all this attachment energy, but we go through, all of us go through rejection. We don't just walk a straight line and get everything we want. We have moments when we want something, we can't get it, when a person doesn't return our feelings, or we get excluded. So we also, all of us, have thwarted attachment energy. We're ready to attach, but we're rejected, or there's nothing there to attach to. So when I discovered that you can take this powerful force of attachment and the thwarted part of it that is frustrated and makes you doubt yourself and makes you feel that you're not enough and that you're somehow the cause of whatever problems you have connecting with people, that we take that thwarted energy and we can finally attach it to the self. Mm. And in order to do that, you have to separate the self into these two parts, and it wound up becoming three parts, but that's a longer story. Big you and little you, or the adult self and the child self.
And then came the outer child.
But no, eventually, yes, I added that was the third part. So it became a three-part framework. But and that winds up being very helpful. But the most profound was discovering that I had already studied inner child dialogues, and I had taken, you know, as a therapist, I had taken professional training and I was underwhelmed by it. Mm. It seemed hokey to me and artificial. But of course, at the time, I was at the top of my game. I was so happy. You know, I took the training, but it didn't mean much. But when I was going through my abandonment, and when my therapist, Richard Robertiello, he's the one who designed the big little paradigm. When he taught me to really tease those parts apart as far as possible and have a cognitive self and an inner child, an abandoned inner child self, and conceptualize those two parts of myself being far apart, and then having the cognitive part give love and attention to the child part. Ask the child part deep questions, show concern, show you want more. And then to discover that I didn't love my inner child. I hated her. She was repulsive. You know why? She was gigantic and obese and hideous, in my opinion. And even though she was a little bit, and I had to go through like 3 weeks of having fake dialogues that felt stupid, but I did them for Richard Robertiello because he was instructing me to do it, and eventually broke through and realized that my inner child, who was this child who had been rejected because of obesity in school, that this child was lonely and scared, and I had compassion for her. And that was the moment of self-love. And it was so profound that I realized that I found a way of promoting healing. And it wasn't an easy way. It could take 3 weeks of effort or longer.
3 weeks sounds pretty short.
The healing, then that's the beginning.
Yeah.
3 weeks of struggle. Woo! And now you can begin like a 10-year process. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, abandonment recovery is like alcohol recovery. It's you get into recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may abstain, which is only a component of recovery, but you get into recovery. You're in recovery. You're not like, oh, I solved that problem. And that's the way abandonment recovery is. You begin to develop a relationship with yourself. And as you work with it, it gets better and better and better and better.
I was thinking about this because I was thinking about, I saw something about rejection trauma. And I don't know if you personally view abandonment trauma separate from rejection trauma, but I'm curious in your research, have you seen any differences? So similar to you, I mean, you were rejected by your peers. In the seventh grade, I became the school slut and the girl that no one was allowed to be friends with, like essentially like overnight, you know? And I'm just curious if you see any differences in the impact in kids being rejected by their parents versus being rejected by your peers. Do you see any big differences there in how that impacts someone?
Well, being rejected by your peers is traumatic. And plus, that is abandonment. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time like putting that in a separate category. Being rejected by your peers is totally devastating, because when you're little, you are looking to your parents and your aunts and uncles, but you don't know what it would feel like not to have it. So whatever you're presented in family, well, that's what you're getting, you know, and you have all kinds of feelings and you keep distracted and, you know, you do whatever you do as a kid, But when you get into elementary, into junior high school, and then into high school, you are comparing yourself to other people. You know exactly what crowd you're in, who accepts you, who doesn't accept you. You know how popular you are. You know that you're in the third most popular crowd, but the fourth most popular kid in that crowd. You know, I mean, maybe you don't have it down to such a science, but kids know mm-hmm. how they're being, how they fit into the caste system, the social caste system. Any exclusion, any rejection, any bullying hurts so deeply, because at that point, the question is, who am I? How much am I worth? How do I rate? How acceptable am I? Will I be thrown away? Am I valuable enough to be kept? Can I hold on to someone's interest? Do I have any, am I attractive enough as a personality? Do I have enough compelling qualities in me to be okay with people? You are now asking those questions because you see other kids who have the confidence to walk on the playground and tell a funny joke and everybody laughs. Whereas maybe you, I don't know about you, but might be too shy to do something like that. You're comparing yourself to everybody else. And where do you fit in? And so you're conscious of your place in the pecking order. And then while you're judging that and you're figuring that out, and you get rejected, you can imagine the impact that that has. And this is so much more dramatic than any of the literature would ever suggest.
And especially now.
It gets worse and worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was like when that happened to me, I mean, I already had... you know, stuff with my family. I probably have told you this before, but that's when I first got sent to a therapist, was at 9 for separation anxiety. And years later, I asked my mom, did you tell them that you were an alcoholic and that you and dad fought all the time? And she said, no, I didn't think it was relevant. but yeah, I mean, it started with, you know, I couldn't go to sleepovers. And then one night I woke up in the middle of the night and I felt like I was going to die, you know, if I couldn't sleep in my mom's bed. And it started this pattern of me going to sleep in my bed. And then every night I'd wake up and go swap places with my dad. But it was really interesting, like getting the, I was so parentified too. So like, I just remember being aware of like the conversations that my parents were having with my pediatrician. And I remember my pediatrician being like very like hardcore, like you just force her, you know, like, eventually I got past it. I think finally when we got there, it was like, I could walk, I could go. My mom was willing to walk me back to my room as many times as I needed to. And eventually I could, but obviously like nothing was addressed underneath. But so do you not view, so in your opinion, like is separation anxiety just trauma? And like, if a child has separation anxiety, is that always indicative of some sort of traumatic experience?
No, it can depend. But yeah. In your case, when you were having, you needed to sleep in your parents' bed, and that's just the way you were.
It's related to my mother's alcoholism. I mean,
It came from all that deprivation and all that. We don't have to spell it out even. This was how it computed in you, that you needed to be in your mother's bed. And it just doesn't mean that you were contaminated. It's just that in the natural development and growth, that's how it came out for you. You were a plant and your one leaf went this way looking for the sun or whatever. And it's so you could pathologize that and say that it definitely was a result of trauma, but you know, we're all formed by various kinds of trauma. So yes, but in no way does it suggest that It was anything more than a practical concern for your parents. How do they get their bed back?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So has your...
Did they shame you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Like from the perspective of like, you know, one day I was in the fourth grade and I remember one day I walked into school and my friend was like, CJ told us that you sleep in your mom's bed every night. And my dad had played tennis with CJ's father.
Oh no.
Last weekend. Yeah. So from that perspective, yeah, no, they did. And maybe not. It was very subtle. The shame, you know, it wasn't like verbally abusive or anything. But the subtle message is in that because like my mom's drinking was a secret from the rest of the world, but my separation anxiety, obviously that it didn't apply to that. So yes. So
what happened that you were all of a sudden, you know, ostracized like that? And
I gave
socially?
Me and my friend, we got invited to a high school party. We were in the seventh grade. And we were like the more mature girls, taller, you know, first to get our periods. And we gave blowjobs to two boys because I thought it would make us cool. You know, we weren't pressured like into doing it. Like it wasn't like a situation where like, you know, we were forced to do something. Like it was definitely, we definitely chose to do it. So then when we came back to school, I went to a private school out in Philadelphia. It's called Episcopal Academy. And the whole school knew about it. But the thing was that like my friend had a brother who was in 10th grade. So she fared okay. Like she got harassed some, but then he protected her. And somehow was like, she was still able to keep some friends. And I didn't. And then I just imploded. And it was shortly after that, maybe like a couple of weeks after that, I met another boy, like he went to a different school and he was in the 9th grade. And I asked my mom if I could hang out with him. And she said, no. So then I just started sneaking out in the middle of the night to go and spend time with him. And then that's when I started to smoke pot. And then eventually my parents caught on and they put a security system like on the house, like to keep me in. But, yeah, it was the way that I dealt with it was, I put up a mask of like, this is who I'm choosing to be, you know, like I didn't act like ashamed by it. And then proceeded to like, not really be able to have any friends, girlfriends really until I got sober. Because I think I just projected that shame, especially when I drank. I mean, I was a hot mess when I drank, you know, like I was the one that caused scenes. And I think a lot of it was, I knew eventually you were going to decide that you didn't like me. Right. So it's like, I'll just give it to you. Or what I did was I didn't try to make friends with other people. Like I just acted as if I'm better than you. I have no interest in being your friend because deep down inside, I knew that it wouldn't take you very long for you to decide that you didn't like me, you know? But I mean, that's why, I probably would have killed myself if I didn't have drugs or alcohol. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, yep. From that medication point on, at the time.
Being fucked up was my number one priority, you know?
Yeah.
And then that just got escalated with how involved my parents got, you know, and then getting sent to rehabs and boarding schools and outpatients and all that stuff. So it definitely helped in progressing things along in a rather fast manner. Because by 17, I was drinking every day, you know, and by 18, I was drinking around the clock and then eventually got sober. So, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, the whole thing about being ostracized after the blowjobs,
mm-hmm.
I could be wrong. But that you developed a lot of post-traumatic growth from that, because that was a devastating situation to be in. You with separation anxiety, you know, now having a stigma. Mm-hmm. So you took that and you said, I'm going to be me. This is me. And you somehow became that that became a source of strength, at least. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm picturing, that out of that emerged a rugged individualist. Unfortunately, one who, you know,
partake in substances.
Yeah. But I mean, it's almost inevitable that you would go through that phase.
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting too, is like, so that was the other thing too, is like, so I ended up hanging out, like getting back together with that boyfriend in the ninth grade, and our parents let us be together. And then listen, and then at the end of ninth grade, I woke up one morning and I just stopped. He was my life. I stopped hanging out with all my friends. It was just only him and me. He got sent away to Idaho in the middle of the night.
Oh.
I woke up one morning because he had gotten in trouble and his parents arranged to have him shipped away. And he also was my source to like pot and alcohol. So talk about that. Like literally over, like I have a series of abandonments that like occurred almost like overnight without warning, like all throughout my childhood. And then that was the big fear in adulthood. And I would manifest it. Like that was my big fear, was that out of nowhere overnight, somebody was going to decide that they didn't like me anymore. And that's not what happened to him, but like, yeah, that was like such a horrible and scary experience, him getting sent away like that. It was horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah. And there's absolutely nothing you can hang on to when you discover that people can A, move away, B, die, or C, reject you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, that's the whole thwarted attachment energy thing, that that you can't take that for granted, no matter how close you are and how well it works, and it suddenly it can be taken away. So not everybody has to learn that lesson at such a tender age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the reason that I was telling you that. So then, but I remember he came back and then we hung out and then we started hanging out with a group of people. And then this is when my alcoholism really escalated to where like I would always cause scenes. So eventually like I wasn't allowed to hang out with them anymore. So he would like hang out with me on Sundays. And then like anytime it was like something fun to do, he was always with those people. So, you know, I would try to make friends and it wouldn't take them very long. This is my senior year of high school before they'd realize they didn't like me. But I remember I reconnected with the other girl who I'd given the blowjob with. And I just remember, and this was when Facebook first started, but like, I just remember being so jealous because she had fared okay. Like her life was normal after, like, you know, quasi normal. Like she was part of the popular group. She stayed at that school. Like she had fun things to do. And I just remember being so jealous. But when I started the podcast, I reached out to her and was like, I'm starting this podcast and I'd really be curious to know, how do you think this experience impacted you? Shut me down completely. So I thought,
So there you go. That, mm-hmm. that she had a brother who protected her. And of mm-hmm. course we're happy that she had that. I mean, mm-hmm. she, you know, who knows if she hadn't had that, what kind of torment she would have. But anyway,
her mom died from cancer like a couple of months actually after that happened.
Oh,
yeah.
But she didn't develop the depth, you know, she mm-hmm. her post-traumatic growth didn't flower
Mm-mm.
in that way.
She's like, I don't even speak about it. Like I'm away from my life. And for me, I'm like, all right, like this is what happened. You know, it shaped me who I am. I don't have any shame about it anymore.
In the five stages of abandonment, it's battering withdrawal, internalizing rage, and lifting. And a lot of people lift when they kind of come out of the trauma. Mm-hmm. And when they lift without their feelings intact, and they become more numb than they were before. Mm-hmm. So they actually become less of who they are over time, and they have to fill it in with, you know, materialism or having a career and climbing a ladder of, you know, a professional ladder or something like that. They continue to strive, but they don't connect emotionally. Mm-hmm. They have a whole part of themselves that's closed off, and that's okay. I mean, the world is full of people like that. We don't begrudge them. It's a wonderful defense mechanism. But it does leave a lot of incompatibility. because the ideal situation is when you lift out of the trauma of being found out that you the blow jobs and losing all your friends and being stigmatized and all. The ideal situation is that you actually keep all of those feelings with you and that you use them and work them through and have relationships and have them, you know, have go through all these, you know, these repetitions of these feelings that make you who you are. Mm-hmm. And then that allows you to connect to other people. It gives you connective. It gives you a Velcro surface.
Okay. Shifting topics to another thing that I wanted to bring up, just the whole, equating, love with insecurity. How does that develop in a child? I mean, I understand the whole, like the insecurity aspect of it, but how is it equating it to love? Just because it's intermittent when we feel love with our parents and that's just what we equate it to be.
Well, what is a child doesn't have words for all this stuff. A child is striving for the connection with the parent, for the recognition, approval, you know, impressing, getting all the goodies, the kudos from the parent. The child is striving and for that. And if it's a hard reach, if the child is, if it's an alcoholic parent, usually the child is driving for something, the parent is present but not fully present. And the child is striving for something that they can never reach. So it's like wanting something but not quite getting it. Or, and very often it's, you know, there's an alcoholic father or a father who leaves the family because of divorce. The child wants something and isn't getting it. So when you get older and you go to, you know, you're in a situation where you're having romantic connections with people, the ones who trigger your interest are the ones who have you striving for something that you can't quite get. So it gives you sort of a tendency to be attracted to the unavailable.
Is it
because that's what you felt as a kid?
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Is it okay? So let's say that are we initially, does there have to be some sort of a draw to the person in a way? Like, let's say they haven't exhibited any, you know, unavailability yet, or maybe they have, and we just, but let's just say, like, you know, they haven't like waited to like, they haven't not returned your text, or to you, they have not yet triggered your fear of abandonment. And so it's like in that moment when they do, like you're kind of hooked in, but is there already a draw? Like, has the trauma bond already been formed? Like, is there already something that's like pulling us to them that we're sensing, or could it be anybody? And then as soon as they show that they trigger our fear of abandonment, like we're in.
That would vary from person to person, history to history. And, but a lot of times a person can seem all in and then prove actually not to be. And I think we have an uncanny sense that this person is capable of pulling away. And if one of the two of us is going to pull away, it's going to be them, not me. I'm in like Flint, and they're the one who's going to pull away, and that makes them very attractive. You know, my abandoner, who I was so in love with, and I still admire him. He's one of the finest people on the planet. Honestly, he's an amazing person. But he had the ability to make unilateral decisions. He could decide to do something that was good for him. And that was sexy. I couldn't. Every decision I make, I'm thinking about what the other person needs or wants or expects or whatever. He was kind and considerate too. But he also could be unilateral. And so even though when he walked out on me and he was so loving and so attentive, how could he do this? Mm. But when I got completely honest, I had to realize that right from the beginning, I knew that he had the capacity
to leave you. I think you've said that
before. Leave. Mm. Yeah. But I never was conscious. I mean, I was always a little tiny bit insecure. I mean, to the point that I never felt it. I felt so free, but I was a little tiny bit insecure. And that was his hook. Mm. Somehow I found someone who would.
When do you think you first picked up on that?
When did I pick up on that? Oh, maybe 6 months into my abandonment grief, when I was hardly able to breathe. And I was doing all this desperate research, trying to understand how something could be this devastating. I think that I had to face, you know, the more responsibility we can take for ourselves, the better. So I had to say, you know what? I think that there was something about him that, even though he was the last person I'd ever expect to abandon me, there was always something about him that made that possible. And I think I was attracted to that. It took, you know, to be honest, you know, the rigorous self-honesty that it takes to be in some kind of recovery. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was layers and layers and layers and layers I had to break through to come up with the fact that somehow I was attracted to him because he had that capacity.
Was your fear of abandonment ever triggered, like in the beginning when you guys were dating? Was there ever a hiccup?
Oh, yes. At the beginning of every new relationship that I've ever had, oh, the fear at the beginning, it's wonderful. I lose like 20 pounds. I mean, my fear of abandonment is triggered just by falling for someone.
There's no shit. I posted that one time. I posted something and said, I'm not dating for marriage. I'm dating to kickstart my next weight loss thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And somebody was like, you're promoting disordered eating. I'm like, fuck you. It's a fucking joke.
A joke, but not really.
It's also like, worked. I wish I could eat. I'm so stressed out that I can't. Only diet that's ever worked for me my whole life, Susan.
Yes. It's true.
I have to start the Stillman diet.
Well, the Stillman diet was very radical. So someday you want to hear about the Stillman, ask. Oh, you could find out online. It's Atkins now.
But were you were so young. So were your parents looking into it? How did you find out about it?
I went on a diet at the end of the fifth grade, but that was the diet eating half a hot dog, only one piece of toast. Drinking half a cup of cocoa.
And you probably gained
weight. No dessert.
Yeah.
Well, I was also gaining in heights. And so I lost all the weight and entered the sixth grade, like looking like all the other kids. Mm-hmm. I wasn't skinny, but I was average. And I immediately had friends. Mm. Yeah. But it was... That when I went on Stillman, I was 21, I think, 22.
Okay. Stillman stick figure.
Stick
figure. So, do you have any, and it could be recently or not, and obviously feel free to change any details, but do you have any proud patient moments or anything significant healing that you'd like to share, some wins of somebody that you've worked with, or just a profound transformation that you've seen to give some people some fucking hope?
Well, you know, the thing is that the mistake is that, you know, to give people the idea that, well, just get into abandonment recovery and, you know, you'll start to see big changes, and you will see big changes, but it is being in recovery. It is a slow, steady process and you have to work it, you know. Mm-hmm. So not to give unrealistic expectations, because then people blame themselves and think they're not doing a good enough job. But this stuff is deeply set into the brain, and it takes time to like find new behaviors and practice new ways of being. So that's one very important thing. The other important thing, I usually add this to make sure everyone understands that when you change something, you don't change it perfectly. Mm. So, you know, like you mentioned codependency way back at the beginning. If you happen to be a people pleaser, that's what you said, people pleasing. Yeah. If you happen to be a people pleaser and you tend to be codependent and you know that you're too much so, to the point that you're, that people don't celebrate your birthday, but you celebrate everyone else's birthday, you know, that kind of thing. And there are millions and millions of people who find themselves in non-symmetrical relationships where they're doing most of the work. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so you want to change it. You don't want to be a people pleaser. Your community, you're overcompensating, and somehow that's making people disrespect you. So what do you do? So you don't expect to fix it perfectly. You only have to be a tiny bit less of a people pleaser. You don't have to stop being a people pleaser. It's asking too much. Mm-hmm. If you're a people pleaser, you're probably going to always be a people pleaser, but maybe just a little tiny bit less, a little tiny bit of putting yourself first, a little tiny bit of not jumping at the bit to give someone, you know, what they need, a little tiny bit of restraint, not a lot. You can still say, oh, that's such a beautiful dress. Oh, that looks so good on you. You can still do your people pleasing, but just all it takes to make the biggest difference in your life is a very, very small change. Mm-hmm. That's the difference that can make the difference. So that's the message of hope that I try to leave with people, because people feel they have their life is a disaster. Everywhere they look, they get it rejected all the time. They have no job. They don't know what they're doing. And their house is a mess, and all the different problems that people can have. But yeah, get into recovery. You just need to change things little here and there. And it reaches a certain level of acceptability without having to fix it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And your life starts to move forward.
I just did an episode on clutter.
Oh.
People don't want... Yeah, I've noticed it's like money topics and clutter. People don't want to have to look at that shit. I deal with it. I've got this fucking closet that I got to deal with. So
are we in your closet?
No, we're in a real office now. We have
our first interview was on the floor. Your closet.
Mm-hmm, that's where I started, next to my cat's litter box on the floor. Just doing my thing. So do you have workshops coming up?
I have one in the most beautiful place in Boone, North Carolina, coming up not this weekend, but next weekend.
Nice.
It's called the Art of Living Institute, Art of Living Recovery Center. And it's it's so beautiful. It's at the top of the mountains, of the Blue Ridge Mountains, overlooking all the mountain ranges. And the most beautiful buildings, and the workshop is fantastic.
Well, I want you to know, people are big fans of you that listen to this podcast. In particular, his name is Dominic. You've helped him so much. He's obsessed with your work, and everybody is. And I'm so glad that I got to talk with Peter. And it'll be actually really fun to interview you two together and reminisce about things. That would be so fun.
It would be X-rated if you interviewed us together.
I love it.
Yeah.
Mm. So that must have been cool to just see him. Did you know that he was such a hot mess when you first met him?
No.
No. He wasn't sober yet, was he?
Yes.
Yeah, he was.
Okay. He was a very well-respected social worker and, you know, clinician working within the school district, a different district than mine, and we would meet for lunch, and he was an impressive person, sober, very, very together. But he's completely open, completely, his life is a book, and it's wide open to help other people with.
He was talking about how when you were at his wedding that you were talking with some of his friends who knew him more recently of the hot mess. And then you got to tell the old hot mess. And he said, yeah, I don't know if I want you guys talking together.
I've never known Peter to be a hot mess. He's just too much of, he's very wise.
It was so funny. He was talking about the one relationship that really, where he, everything came up for him. And I was like, so was it just like, that weekend, like it was, he was like, yeah, just the weekend. I was like, that's all it takes, baby. Just one nice weekend together. You're hooked.
Oh, that's
so well. Thank you so much. Anything else you want to plug?
Well, I sell the program on video.
Oh, you do now?
On my website. You can go to my website and download all 5 Heru exercises, the whole program.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Susan. Thanks for coming back. We'll see you next
time. Well, thank you, Andrea. Okay, see you next time. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go.